Hi, welcome to WORT 89.9 FM radio. Today's date is April 28th, and I'm your host, Anita. So, on today's topic, we are going to discuss the topic that is quite interesting. So, what do these have in common? The bride walks down the aisle with the canon in D, softly echoing her steps. The almost crescendo as Queen sings Galileo in Bohemian Rhapsody. And lastly, the animated telling of the classical bit Fantasia. What are they? What does Canon in D by Shohan Pachel have? Bohemian Rhapsody and Fantasia? Classical artists or classical musicians? So today on Perpetual Notion Machine, we're going to explore classical music, what is considered classical music, and how it is changing, and how does it change? How is it changing, and how do we learn with it? Without much further ado, I'm joined by Andrew Aziz from San Diego State University School of Music and Dance. Hi, introduce yourself, Andrew.
Hi, Anita. Thank you so much for having me. I'm Andrew Aziz, Associate Professor of Music Theory at the School of Music and Dance, San Diego State University. Originally from the East Coast, from New Jersey, but I've been working here in California for 6 years, and I have my doctorate in music theory. So I've been invested in these topics and, you know, teaching music for a very long time. I'm a classical pianist. I've been playing since I'm 37 now, so over 30 years of piano performance. So I come at this from the performance, the practical side, also the research side and teaching side. So it's a privilege to be able to share some thoughts with your audience.
Oh my God, amazing. So the whole gamut, you run classical music, you've played it, you've taught it, and you've seen it. That's amazing. So right. What is considered classical music?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think classical music, it depends on if classical with a big C or a little c. Classical music with a capital C does imply the Viennese school. I know you had prompted a couple of composers.
Yeah, Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven.
Right. So people think of Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven as the classical composers, and no doubt they are classical composers. They are also composers of the classical era, big C, uppercase C, as opposed to romantic era composers such as Brahms, Tchaikovsky, or Baroque composers, say like Bach or Handel. But I think a lowercase C, classical, it refers to musical traditions going back to the ancient Greeks, then through the Catholic Church, so Middle Ages, then expanding through to the European tradition of the Common Practice era, emanating from Austria, Germany, France, Italy, also Spain. And I think today when people think of classical music, they have the association with the concert hall tradition, or maybe a chamber music tradition, in which a type of music is performed and the audience interacts with a certain way. And I think that is in contrast to, say, vernacular music, which might be received when it's being performed in a different way. So I think there are connotations to classical music aside from, you know, the strict definition of what the music kind of is, what is and what isn't.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, I like how that it's based on like the time and region as well. So for me, I think of it also when it probably first started, maybe the uppercase C may have been something novel at the time. I mean, wouldn't you think, you know, these superstars, I guess you could say, like Mozart or whatever. I mean, I'm just curious. It's just a kind of off the beat question about, were they at their time the Harry Styles of that time?
Yeah, I mean, well, Mozart, some of these composers didn't live as long as they would have liked. Mozart, amongst the three kind of ones, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, Mozart had the shortest lifespan. And when he was alive, he was known as much for his performance prowess as his compositional prowess. Beethoven was a famed pianist too, until he wasn't able to perform anymore once he lost his hearing. Haydn was a kind of a court composer. He wrote for a royalty and did it based on commission. I mean, Mozart also wrote based on commission, but he was more known more as a virtuoso. So I think, I guess you could think of the singer-songwriter that kind of performs their own songs and composes their own songs. Mozart was kind of more in that vein. Haydn less so the performer. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool. So, I mean, thank you for giving us like the history of the Lower Sea and the Big Sea. And sometimes it's easy to mix them, as you said, that they are two different, and there's the Romantic. And I did take a class a long time ago. We went over the Romantic, the Baroque. So it was really nice to differentiate those two. And they were, and of course, I know that these are the bigger names, but I'm sure there were other people who were also virtuosos in their own right.
Of course. Yeah.
They just, some people took, I forget the Mozart comparison. There's a movie that came out.
Amadeus.
Yes. Yes. There was another person at the same time, but he just kind of, it's also good to note that there were other people who were there as well. Sure. So now that we've talked about what that is, let's talk about the instruments. I know there's quartets and things of that. Could you explain that organization and what it actually does for the classical music, I think?
So of course, you have different kind of members of the orchestra, different ensembles. You have string instruments, violin, viola, and woodwinds, clarinet, oboe. I have brass instruments, trumpets, French horns, percussion instruments, timpani, snare drum, then you also have piano, which kind of doesn't fit really neatly into any of them, but it's more of a solo instrument. But the biggest differences between the instruments, and I know that your radio station has this show has a science bent, so you have differences in register, you have differences in timbre. So scientifically, the instruments have different frequencies and sine curves, amplitudes, and Fourier properties, if we're really getting very technical. The way that they blend is crucial to orchestration, whether it be in a symphony orchestra or a quartet. Sometimes you have ensembles that actually mix timbres. So it's also worth considering how the instruments are played, physically played, and what notes they can generate. So for example, the piano has 88 discrete keys, and it's impossible to play the wrong note unless you hit the wrong key. But violin, on the other hand, has a continuum. They don't have discrete keys or buttons that you can press. So it's possible to be off by a small margin, kind of in between notes. Brass instruments have valves, and you'd have to generate different notes based on breath support. So every instrument has its production challenges, as well. So I try to go after that question from a couple of different dimensions.
I know I've heard of pitch. So does pitch also I'm thinking of like someone who's a conducting or seeing a violinist or violist. I don't know what the word is. As you said, it's a continuum. So is it hearing that lets you know if it's off by like, as you said, a little bit? Because with the piano, you can tell just by the press of the key or the trumpet. I'm just curious about pitch. Or maybe we can talk about what pitch is. Is it related? It may not be.
Yeah, pitch is really kind of a height. It's a certain frequency.
Okay.
Obviously, the orchestra needs to be sort of in tune with itself. Interestingly enough, the concert Meister concert mistress is going to give the tuning note, and once the main string instrument has given the tuning note, violin, then the other instruments have the ability to kind of adapt at the beginning of the concert. With wind instruments, you could sort of maybe kind of pull out the mouthpiece or something that makes sure that everybody is playing in tune.
That's what I thought. Because I hear it every. I always wondered what that period was in the beginning of a performance. Someone playing like a note, and it keeps going, and that's actually a very cool point. Not only your group, but the groups in comparison with every group have to be in tune. That's pretty cool. Does it change, or is it always like, I mean, I guess my question with that goes back to like the classical artists. Do they change that particular part, or is it always a constant like tune? I mean, depending on the, you know, the period in which they were, you know, the pieces.
Well, yeah. Well, I think, I mean, different, this kind of segues maybe into the next question too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Western art music, as it is termed, classical Western art music, kind of synonymous with each other, will tend to play the 12 discrete pitches within an octave that are associated with the labeling system C, C sharp, D, D sharp. And typically speaking, they won't play sounds that are not amongst those 12. But other cultures will explore different tunings. In fact, classical music explored different tunings with different instruments. There were historical tunings that were based more upon frequency of the overtone series, where they'd have certain intervals that were more in tune and other ones that were less. But in modern day Western art tuning, it does tend to be, you know, one of the 12 notes that you can play on the piano, and the other instruments will try their best to, you know, play those notes in tune. But with other cultures, they'll have a tendency to explore different scales, and the notes that are, quote, in tune for Western art music are not necessarily the pitches that are in tune for them. And they have very different sound worlds. So I'm going to let you present what I believe to be the next question, and I'll continue to
Oh no! I it's just I'm curious about the sound notes. Sorry, I sometimes go a little bit up. So, what out of the ones that you've discovered outside of the Western, which ones do you consider like really interesting in their measure? In I guess their scale.
I think one culture that is always addressed at least somewhat in my class because of certain Western art composers that are very much indebted to them. So Debussy was a French composer that was very interested in the gamelan tradition. And gamelan, Javanese gamelan, often uses a five-note scale, but those notes aren't necessarily mapping on to a five-note collection that you would hear, you know, in the Western sphere. It's sort of five notes of their choosing, and it creates their own sound world. I know Chinese folk music tends to also use a more limited pitch vocabulary at times, often choosing a particular collection that Western art theory would call pentatonic. But their tuning and the instruments that they use to play it aren't necessarily the ones that would be used in Europe, say, you know. But it goes just beyond pitch dimension. There's also, you know, cultures where the rhythmic complexity is actually very difficult to notate in terms of Western notation. For example, Indian Carnatic music. I have a colleague who works on that music, and he has to transcribe it in Western notation during, you know, when he's presenting research. But it's really, it's not easy to do because of the complexities that are specific. And interestingly, the people are so familiar with the patterns. I mean, they seem really complex to us, but to them, there's learned tradition, and a lot of it is orally, you know, passed on. So they're less concerned with how it looks when it's notated, although I'm certain that they have specific notation that is different than ours, you know, that we teach in, you know, conservatories and music schools in the Western world. They definitely have, all cultures have very different sound worlds, and they use, you know, specific pitch materials, instrumentation, you know, different rhythmic patterns and different features that I suppose would be, quote, lowercase c classical to them.
and then uppercase. You know, that is that is really cool. I mean, I you know, I watch a lot of this. I mean, just a very small exposure, I guess, Bollywood, and to hear that note, I think one of the ladies who was known as the Nightingale of India passed away, and I mean, this is more of a modern take on a style. I mean, that's amazing the way their voice. I've only heard it in the voice register, not necessarily the instrumentation, and I can imagine trying to take notes from that when you're from a different, you know, school, like, and you know, that's really a true point.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said.
Yeah, so now I'm gonna ask you the big question: why classical music?
Yeah,
for you.
So, if I had to defend the quote benefits of classical music, I would say that. It taps into both some of the natural acoustical properties of the overtone series, which is extraordinarily universal, whether we like it or not, as well as the grammatical properties of language. Now, because the grammar of classical music is based fundamentally on consonants and dissonance, and the way it weaves between certain intervals, harmonies.
Could we describe consonants and dissonance just for everybody?
Sure. Yeah. Consonants and dissonance, acoustically speaking. So if you have large ratios in terms of, say, the octave is a 2-to-1 ratio, a perfect fifth is a 3-to-2 ratio, perfect fourth, 4-to-3 ratio. So the kind of bigger intervals in the overtone series are considered consonant, and then the smaller ones, as you kind of get like 9 to 8, 10 to 9, they tend to be dissonant, acoustically dissonant. But in the tonal music that has a key, tends to be the case that if you have a particular chord and the chord has certain notes in it, then if you have a chord that contains sort of only limited notes, then that will tend to be consonant. But if you infuse other ones around it that are more embellishing, it will tend to create things that sound dissonant. So it has this sort of solar system of relationships. And the way in which tonal music fluctuates between different sounds, which it kind of works with the acoustical properties, is I think it's inconsistent with the way, you know, things naturally unfold anyway. I mean, if you look at plants or microbiology, and so they have all these patterns are there. And then there's also the grammatical angle. So, classical music has harmonic progressions. You have certain chords, and they don't occur in a random order. Certain orders sound more kind of grammatically synchronous than others. And when I teach harmonic progressions, I compare them to parts of speech and language. So that every chord in a phrase has its place, just like every part of speech has its function in a linguistic sentence. You have subjects and verbs and objects, and music you have tonic and predominant and dominant, and so everything kind of has its position. Everything has its own function. So really the acoustical properties and the grammatical properties, I think those are two dimensions of how I think studying, listening to classical can serve some benefit, even if it's subliminal, even if you aren't necessarily aware intellectually of what these things are called or what exactly they are. I think they will subliminally impact you because of the relationships that the music contains. That's my opinion anyway.
That's cool. Like, I like the grammar, Pomona. Like, it's just the way you speak. I mean, I've taken a few class. I played guitar, but it's not piano, but we have the basis of the piano chords and the whole dominant and minor chords, the whole, I guess, the mood. You know, he would be like, some sound happy and some sound sad. You can kind of hear it as well, grammatically. Yeah. You can totally sense that.
Absolutely. But, you know, pivoting off of that, I mean, composers will also choose certain chords because of literally the way they sound, like the aesthetic quality of it. And even not every decision that a composer makes is purely based upon what's sort of grammatically expected. But certain composers, especially as you venture into the later 19th century, early 20th century, different artistic movements, you know, symbolist movements, impressionist movements, notes and chords are chosen literally for how they sound rather than necessarily how they function. So it's less about syntax and kind of more about, you know, how it might make you feel, what picture it will paint. So that's how different styles and periods of music will use materials differently.
It's like art, you know, we go from painting, the fine art, and then we go to impressionists. That's actually really cool. No wonder they lend themselves so well, like, you know, very, very good impression. They always have a track playing that is of a classical bend. And I'm like, oh, that makes sense. It, you know, the movement moved from what we used to paint to something more artistic, I guess. So then... has there been a resurgence in classical musical interest? You know, to your knowledge.
Yeah. I don't know that I personally can speak to a resurgence in classical music interest amongst the wider population, but as somebody who's in the academy and who's aware of at least local outreach, I could speak to the scene here in San Diego. Even though I'm not originally from here, I'm originally from New York, where I don't think they necessarily need to have deliberate infusion. It is, I mean, classical music is sort of in every single corner, every nook and cranny. Perhaps not so much as naturally where I am now, but I would say that there are definitely efforts to engage the new generation, whether it be making sure that the concert tickets for students are, you know, cheaper. If the programming is more inclusive, especially women composers and composers of color. I think more generally, the way in which media could excerpt classical music, whether it be, I'll say TV commercials, but people don't really watch like cable anymore.
I do, but you're right. I do.
Sure. Yeah. That's. I mean, I consider myself an older millennial who still kind of believes in channels.
I do.
But, right. But like whether, you know, streaming services or you know, podcasts or I mean, radio, even if they don't listen to it in a car, but they still stream it. Or people maybe randomly stumbling into classical music on YouTube because that just seems to be where the algorithm takes them. There's a lot more accidental access to classical music, but right, I mean, they may stumble into it, and if the product is good, then people kind of keep listening. But I do think that classical organizations are conscientiously, and this has not always been the case, but I think they are trying to reach out to those outside of the academy, which I consider myself firmly in, and I'm trying as hard to make it as relatable as possible, because I think people have certain preconceptions about who should study it and, you know, who would benefit. But I think, you know, when anyone finds a product of high quality, so long as that it is pitched to them in a way that seems accessible as opposed to something that's exclusive, if people feel comfortable, enjoy the product, they're going to engage it. That's what I think.
That's true. I mean, one of the things, I think Bridgerton or like period pieces, for some reason, we always tie them to classical music. And But there's also, you know, they've also the retake of a modern piece in a classical style. I've seen some songs that have been done, I guess, in violin or the octaves have done. I don't know. It's going to take some time. And I really do like your presentation of going to different communities and supporting underserved communities that haven't had the access to it. Breaking that like stereotype that, oh, you must be of a certain level. And I think some of it may have been good or bad, you know, things like, you know, Mozart was amazing, but you don't have to be, you know, he worked, you know, he was different, he was a virtuoso, but that doesn't mean that, you know, the skill set of working hard and learning all the keys and, you know, there's a lot to it than just, you know, there's a lot more than meets the eye, I guess is what I'm saying. And, you know, it's going to take, you know, of course, time, but I'm glad that that's happening. I'm glad that, you know, they're definitely empowering more communities. And so then I guess with question, the next question for me is that too, for you actually, is classical music here to stay?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm much more optimistic about the staying power of classical music, partly because of its conscientious efforts to include really anyone in its production, in its creation, and its performances. I don't think, you know, classical music is as limited to, you know, symphony concert halls or exclusive, or it's not sort of one of these invitation only things. I think the more that the general population thinks that this is for them, the more likely they'll want to go. And I mean, I think this is also linked to, you know, supporting arts programs. I mean, naturally, everything comes down to economics. but I think people view classical performances as, you know, less of a particular time investment or a financial investment, or that you have to dress up and that you have to sit quietly, you know, maybe some breaking some of those stereotypes, or into removing the stigma that there are certain behavioral expectations, or, you know, the concerts are really for certain people. You know, it's really nice living in, you know, San Diego climate where we actually have a lot of outdoor concerts. And so there's a certain amount of informality to an outdoor setting.
Yeah, the speckles of pavilion. I mean, well, that's the organ, but
sure. Yeah, no, I mean, the speckles organ pavilion is one of our gems. We also have a new outdoor concert hall at the Embarcadero. They're actually undergoing a long construction project in our main symphonic hall. The vast majority of the orchestral concerts over the span beginning during the COVID era, where we, of course, weren't having them anyway. So we had more of an infusion of concert, not just classical, but we also had a lot of popular artists come to San Diego because we had not only the climate, but the outdoor venue for it. So I think for a long stretch of time, this was one of the most viable places for performance during the last couple of years. And I think it definitely helped put us on the map a little bit. We got some really high profile performers in our outdoor spaces. Overall, with respect to classical concerts, if they're marketed in a way that are more inclusive, and this can be reflected in the programming, the composers and the artists that are participating in the performance. But if all of those things are taken into account, yes, I do believe classical music is here to stay. Yeah.
Wow, that is amazing. And I feel like the same, I feel the same on that as well. So one more question, who is your favorite classical artist?
I completed my dissertation on two composers, Debussy and Ravel. And they're French composers, and I've done a lot of research on them. I've been to Paris. I haven't been to too many places in the world, I love French art. I love the art in particular of those periods. And Ravel in particular wrote marvelously for piano. And I love their usages of sound worlds, and it sounds like a painting. And I'm a classical pianist, so of course, if I think about my, you know, my favorite artists, I think, well, who is my favorite pianist? So I'll just name one that's living and one that's deceased. Okay. I'd say one of my favorite living pianists is George Lee, who I first heard in a competition some years ago. And fortunately, he has performed in Southern California a bunch of times over the past couple of years, Lee L.I. So I encourage anybody to look up his performances. If you have a chance to, you know, get a ticket, it's definitely well worth it. A pianist who recently passed that has had great influence over me was Leon Fleischer, who had a very devastating hand injury in his early career, but became a famed pedagogue, in particular at the Peabody Conservatory at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. He just passed, I think, about a year ago, but he influenced me in terms of his recordings when I was much younger. There's a constant infusion of, you know, new compositional blood. Even right here in San Diego, we have, you know, a ton of new premieres with the San Diego Symphony. We have a thriving San Diego new music. In regular times, I really just go to as many concerts as time would allow, so I can immerse myself in styles that I'm unfamiliar. And I think you bring open-mindedness to the whatever space that you're listening to music. You have a chance to be moved, and I think people will continue to engage classical music so long as it moves them, and that's really why people listen to music, and I don't think that will ever change.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you for this amazing, take on classical music. This has been WORT 89.9 FM, Perpetual Notion Machine. Thank you, guys. Until next time.